Good. So today we have a local speaker, Sergei Sibiryakov, and I guess most of you by now have had a chance to meet him, at least in a virtual setting, since he joined as a faculty member, McMaster and Perimeter last fall. So Sergei kindly agreed to tell us about some of his work today. So we will hear about how to compute false vacuum decay induced by black hole. Please, Sergei.
Thank you, Christina. It's a pleasure to talk here in the PI. I think it's my first talk after I moved here. So I hope I will get feedback from you. So it's a work still in progress in collaboration with Andrei Shkerin. And the question that I will be asking is actually how do black holes affect probability of false vacuum decay? Yeah, so that's that's quite an old question. So people asked it long ago, and the like first works that we were able to identify, they date back to 80s. But somehow they are inconclusive. So what people did there, they considered various thin shell solutions in Euclidean time that could, in principle, they are of the same class as those solutions that describe false vacuum decay, like bubble nucleation, the creation of true vacuum bubbles inside false vacuum. But they got many solutions, and it's not very clear if any of them and to what extent they actually describe any physical processes. And people themselves, who found this solution, they were not sure, whether they really have the meaning of tunneling or not. And also, yeah, somehow their somewhat results are somewhat controversial. Still, there was a general finding, which is quite natural, that that black holes catalyze, so they enhance false vacuum decay. So why I'm saying it's natural? Well, it's natural for two reasons. First, black hole is an impurity, and any impurity, we believe it enhances, it enhances bubble nucleation. Yeah, just providing seeds for bubble nucleation. And second, black holes, they have temperature, so they excite vacuum, and for that reason, also we expect that they do catalyze vacuum decay. But nevertheless, how to properly compute that basically remained. The question was formulated, but it has remained unknown since like beginning of 90s or late 80s. So there was a recent revival of this topic due to works of Gregory and collaborators, Ruth Gregory and collaborators. And they linked this question to the fact that in standard model, well, if we assume that there is nothing above standard model, or at least nothing till very high energies, then in standard model, the vacuum where we live in, the standard model vacuum is actually not stable, not absolutely stable. So the fixed potential due to loop corrections, it turns around and goes to negative. So our standard model vacuum can decay away. And actually, yeah, the solution goes into runaway, or we don't know if there is any other minimum or not, because it goes already transplanted. Yeah, and the characteristic numbers here are around, basically this maximum and both the maximum and the crossing of zero, they happen when the value of the Higgs is around 10 to 11 GeV. Okay, I'm very rough with numbers here. We actually don't know for sure if the standard model vacuum is metastable even within standard model, because this picture depends on the uncertainties of the measurements in the top mass and actually definition of the top mass and all these kind of things. So in principle, it's still possible within 2 sigma, I think. These numbers change a bit, but within 2 sigma, it's possible that actually there is no crossing of zero and the vacuum, the Higgs potential just goes up. Or it also can be that it actually turns around more than for the central value. Well, nevertheless, that's a possibility. And then the probability of this nucleation process, generally described by this exponential formula. So, we need to tunnel through the potential barrier. So that's an exponentially suppressed process usually. And I will be caring during this talk only about how to calculate the exponent. Of course, for phenomenology, the pre-exponential factor is also relevant, but that's something we'll leave for future. And then in empty space, this exponent is known, and it's very large. It's very large, so it's about 1,000. And again, the precise number depends on the precise form of the potential, which we don't know. But yeah, but it's around 1,000, plus minus another 1,000, okay? But it's pretty big. So once we get this number into exponent, it doesn't matter what the prefactor is, this decay never happens. Well, still it's actually, still it's quite interesting that it's, well, just 1,000, it's not 10 to 6 or whatever. And yeah, actually it's interesting that we live kind of on the verge of metastability of the standard model life. But anyway, okay, it's a big number. So what was claimed by Gregory et al, that with a black hole, this the suppression, it actually decreases, so black hole catalyzes, and for small enough black hole, it goes to zero. Well, or this B naught becomes of order one, meaning that there is no exponential suppression anymore. So yeah, so for small black holes, it's it gets small. And then this is actually a tremendous statement because then it means, so we have to add here the knowledge that black holes evaporate, yeah? So black holes, when they, if they are formed, they produce quantum radiation and their mass decreases. So now, if we had any black hole which evaporated during any moment in the history of the universe, it would catalyze decay of standard model vacuum with probability one. So we get a very strong statement. There cannot be any single possible primordial black hole in our causal past that would evaporate during lifetime of the universe. And that puts very strong restrictions on the models of primordial black holes. Okay, of course, we may not have any primordial black hole, that's true, but okay, then basically we have this option. Either we don't have any primordial black hole, so all these models are completely ruled out, or standard model vacuum is stable. I mean, that's an
How big is the how small does the black hole mass have to be in order to have B order one?
Yeah, it's a few above Planckian mass. So well, a few orders of magnitude above Planckian mass, 10 or 100 or 1,000. Actually, it's not very. I mean, it depends on how the calculation is done. But yeah, it looks to be safely above Planckian. Okay, and yeah, uh-huh. The scale you can understand. The scale actually should be comparable to the scale of this. Well, actually, of the potential of this 10 to 11 GeV, okay, there are some factors, you know, that accumulate 2 pi, 4 pi, whatever, that accumulate, and yeah, then you get something like 10 to 15, I think, GeV or so. But yeah, I mean, a bit varies how we do the calculation. So that's one of the puzzles actually we started with, that it looked like the calculation depends on some strange details, okay?
Thanks.
Yeah, so once a black hole mass reaches a Planckian mass, I think we don't know if we can apply the semi-classical approximation to such a kind of situation, right?
Yeah, you are right. Yeah, this is above Planckian. So this point is above Planckian. So it's 100 Planckian or 1,000 Planckian masses. So, okay. And this point where the suppression vanishes.
I see. Thank you.
Okay, so that calculation and that reasoning. So it's very interesting because it allows to make this qualitative statement, but it has a caveat. Because what was studied in the papers was Euclidean solutions, were Euclidean solutions. So Euclidean solutions living on the Euclidean version of Schwarzschild metric, which is a cigar like this. And okay, so here the radial coordinate changes from Schwarzschild radius to infinity. And the time, the Euclidean time is periodic. Yeah, that's required by regularity of this solution. And well, in fact, they generalized a bit the calculation where they also allowed some a conical singularity, but always that was Euclidean time with periodic boundary conditions. So that means, actually this setup corresponds to calculation and thermal equilibrium. Periodic times mean thermal equilibrium. And then it's not surprising that the suppression goes to zero because when the mass of the black hole decreases, the temperature increases. At some point, it reaches the scale of the height of the potential barrier. And yeah, you just have over barrier jumps. You can think in this way. So everything happens at high temperature. Yeah, I see Matthew has a question.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the temperature is not really sufficient because, if you think of the Fourier content, just of the black body spectrum at a very high temperature, there's a very tiny overlap with the Fourier content of a critical bubble. And that's kind of the more important consideration is the overlap in Fourier content. This goes back to discussions about skirmions and so on and so forth that happened also kind of in the 80s. It's a similar story.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm oversimplifying. So in fact, what is important is not the height of the potential barrier, but the energy of the sphaleron. So the transitions will be, the probability of transitions at high energy, it will be proportional to energy of the sphaleron over temperature. So that's what you will get in thermal bath. And sphaleron energy is parametrically higher than the height of the potential barrier, than the height of this, than this height. So you're right. So there is parametric suppression, but nevertheless, when the temperature exceeds the height, the energy of the sphaleron, these jumps over sphaleron, they become unsuppressed. So in this sense, that's at least my interpretation of the results obtained by Gregory et al. And more like for in a relativistic language, that setup corresponds to Hartle-Hawking vacuum, where the black hole is immersed in thermal bath with the same temperature. So it is in thermal equilibrium. So we have modes that black hole emits, and also there are modes coming inside, toward black hole. So that, everything just remains the same. And these thermal transitions, it is important for them to happen that you have modes moving in both directions. So you have high energy modes moving in both directions and a lot of them that can collide and form the sphaleron and jump over the barrier.
Can I ask a question, Sergey, related to? Yeah. So if indeed we're assuming that if this calculation properly applies to the case of thermal equilibrium, shouldn't we consider for the Higgs potential, not the zero temperature potential, but the thermally corrected one?
Yeah, that's also a good question. That has been addressed in the literature.
Okay.
And for Higgs, it's important. So normally we should not, because normally if we have a three-level potential, then the effects of thermal loops, these are small effects. Yeah, in this semi-classical reasoning, we first take into account the three-level and then loops must be a small correction. Now, for Higgs, that's not true, because for Higgs, the potential itself, the bending is a loop effect. And that's why the loop effects actually come at the same order as the thermal, or thermal come at the same order as calculation and this effective potential. And they are important. And they suppress the process, and then there's debate. Okay, so that's another important effect to take into account, and it may actually change the result as well. But I think, if I do calculation, if I just forget about where this, if I forget about everything except Higgs, for example, and I say, okay, that's my potential for the Higgs. So what is the probability of tunneling in the black hole background? And then this loop effect, thermal effects would be small because we don't have a lot of degrees of freedom. And then I would get this formula essentially using the Euclidean approach at high temperatures. But that's not what I want, because what I want is a black hole which evaporates and there is nothing around, so nothing comes back. Or if there is anything, it has lower temperature, say, I don't know. Well, but let's say there's nothing. That technically corresponds to Unruh vacuum. So that's a different state. And general considerations, they suggest that in that case, the suppression should be, at least larger than in the thermal bath. Why? Because the region which is hot, which black hole heats around it, it is itself of order of the size of the Schwarzschild radius. So it's actually small and it decreases. It's not small at some, but it decreases with the temperature. When the temperature grows, the region which is hot decreases. And then at some point, you know, bubble just does not fit into that region. Yes. So if I have some characteristic scale of the potential, yes, it also, you know, I have some characteristic scale of the bubble, it would not fit inside this hot region. Or this Fowleron does not fit. Okay. So it means that perhaps the exponential suppression, perhaps it does not go to zero. And it can, I mean, that there are many options. It can stabilize to some value, or it can actually even go up. For small black holes, when the bubble does not fit inside, I mean, it's preferential to form it somewhere else, you know, like then around the black hole. Any questions?
So I have a question quick, Sergey. So So the claim is that in the Euclidean picture that you've described, that the enhancement is coming from the assumption of thermal equilibrium uniform in space that results from this Euclidean picture of working with things. Is that accurate? It's thermal catalysis of the decay that that's the claim.
That's the claim. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
I think once you put the black hole, the nucleated bubble, the size of the nucleated bubble becomes smaller. Then it leads to the small Euclidean action. The Euclidean action is determined by the, roughly speaking, the size of the bubble size in the Euclidean space. Once you put the black holes, the size of the nucleated bubble becomes shrinked due to the classical black holes gravitational force.
I agree. I don't contradict that. But my point is the main effect is thermal enhancement. Because if you look, for example, let me see. If you look at the solutions that were found, then the size of the sphaleron, at some point, you know, the radius stopped depending on the temperature. You know, if the temperature is high enough, it's higher than the characteristic size of the sphaleron, you just get the sphaleron on thinner and thinner cigar. But the radius of the sphaleron remains the same, the radius of the solution that they found. So the vanishing of the suppression comes from the fact that the cigar becomes thinner.
The thinner, you mean the thinner means that the Euclidean period becomes smaller?
Yeah, yeah. And that's, okay. You know, just vanishing goes to zero because of that, not because the radius shrink more and more, mm-hmm, the radius mm-hmm. of the bubble. It's true that, yeah, if the size of the bubble is comparable to the size of the black hole, then yes, there is some effect also coming from the geometry. Yeah, in fact, I will come to that. I will see it explicitly in the toy model, that there are two effects, temperature and geometry.
Yeah, okay.
If you come to the toy model.
Yeah. I'd like to have one comment on a recent our paper. I think now Kohei Kamada is also attending this, right?
Hi, Kohei.
Thanks again. Good to see you.
Yeah, actually, recently we worked on how does the thermal effect of the black hole change the vacuum decay rate catalyzed by black hole with Hayashi and Yokoyama?
You calculate the effective potential, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and. Remind me, so your statement was that, okay, sure, I mean, that effect is important, sure. And does it completely suppress the decay or not?
Actually, our conclusion is that the thermal effect does not change the vacuum decay rate because in the under vacuum states, the thermal plasma is relocated near the black holes. And the size of the plasma is smaller than the bubble size. So if the thermal plasma, the size of the thermal plasma is comparable to or larger than the bubble size, it may drastically change the vacuum decay rate. But mm-hmm. if it's not the case, it doesn't change. That's our conclusion.
Yeah. No, but you could. Yeah, but so do you agree? So I think you agree. We are saying the same statement. Yeah, that basically when that the hot region is too small for the bubble to fit in, right? Are you saying that? And that's why we don't expect this radiation to actually affect. Well, we don't expect it to catalyze decay with probability one. Okay, we still don't know what. Okay, good.
Thank you so much. Please go ahead.
Okay, I'd like to add a comment, but it would be good to go ahead, and I can mention after your talk. Thanks.
Okay, good. So yeah, let's move on, and then we'll see at the end. Yeah, that's very nice to have the discussion. I was at this point saying that yeah, the suppression can behave differently, and and then we're actually interested to calculate it. Yeah, because we are interested to calculate, for example, this minimal suppression, if there is any, or maybe asymptotically we approach minimal suppression. Why? Because in the models, typical models where there are primordial black holes, you know, there are a lot of them in the universe, even if they are kind of rare, if their density is small compared to density of whatever, photons, still there are a lot. And for example, I mean, that point was made in by these people. And in the model, they considered, they estimated the number of black holes in observable universe like 10 to 40, right? And then we're really interested. So this B minimal can still be a big number, I don't know, 20, for example, or 30. And still, you know, like multiplied by this huge number of black holes, we'll get that one of them with probability, you know, one will produce a decay. Okay, so that's phenomenologically interesting still to calculate, you know, this number. To be able to do that. Then there are also other reasons to study this process, perhaps more speculative. So one of them is that we're considering, so this false vacuum decay is a non-perturbative, non-local process. So it has been fun to study it in field theory and in many models, and it taught us something about quantum field theory, yeah, actually a lot. So now we are asking the same question in non-trivial background, so it will teach us something about quantum field theory in curved background. That's a semi-classical process. So it's described by semi-classical solutions. So it's solutions of classical equations of motion. And at that level, we can in principle take into account gravity. And then this will teach us something, hopefully, about semi-classical quantum gravity. And we have examples in the past, for example, Coleman, DeLuca, and Hawking-Moss solutions in De Sitter, they gave us quite significant insight into quantum gravity and has continued to give insight. You know? Finally, you know, like in this process, and that also was in the works of Gregory et al, in this process, the black hole mass in general can change. Yeah, that's what they found. And they also found that in principle, well, according to their calculation, it can either decrease or increase depending on various parameters. So that's actually also very interesting. They even found solutions where black hole completely disappears at the end. And then the entropy of black hole should go somewhere. So again, that probably can teach us something about where the entropy of black hole is. And what it is, and maybe that's very speculative. Maybe it tells something about information paradox. But yeah, and we can. We're coming in the realm of these questions. But if you think now, I mean, how to describe tunneling from Unruh vacuum, not thermal state. I don't want a thermal state. I don't want vacuum. I want Unruh state, where half of the modes are thermal and the other half are not. Are in the vacuum. Then there are immediate technical puzzles, which actually we have been puzzled for a long time about. Perhaps they are just look technical on the first side, but probably they're not so technical. Because the first question is where does this bound solution, whatever bubble, where does it live? It cannot live in Euclidean, because in Euclidean we get either vacuum transitions or thermal. And we want something else. So where should we look for it? Where its habitat. Second is how do we quantize the field? Yeah, because we believe, I mean, we just to define Unruh vacuum and Hartle-Fokin vacuum or Boulver vacuum or Minkowski vacuum, we need to quantize fields. Yeah, to define quantum vacuum. And then normally in textbooks, the quantization is done on surfaces that go inside the interior of black hole. Yeah, because the full like black extension of Schwarzschild metric actually contains interior. It also contains another asymptotic region, and it contains a white hole region. And if we want to define something like Hartle-Fokin vacuum or Unruh vacuum, we do quantization actually on the surface that go inside those regions. That seems to suggest that we need to consider this bound solution in spatial domain now on the surfaces extending inside black hole. And then it will depend on what happens inside black hole, and that's strange. And how can it depend on what happens inside black hole? I mean, so yeah, that's very puzzling, very confusing. And finally, yeah, the final question, okay, is how to really implement the fact that we are tunneling from Unruh in the tunneling solution. So the study we are doing is just to address this question in external black hole metrics. So not kind of factor out the issues of gravity and the first step completely. So metric does not change. Yeah, then it looks like we should be able to answer these questions. And I have some comments here, but okay, I don't have probably perhaps time to go into that. Okay, so to answer, we need to go to the basics and recall how do we calculate, how all these bounces come about. And normally actually they come about from, like in classical papers by Coleman et al. And the textbooks, they come about from Euclidean partition function. So in that, but if we do that, if we start from Euclidean partition function, then we cannot really move anywhere because we will be stuck in Euclidean. So there's an alternative approach in real space. Yeah, when we just consider transition amplitudes, like from initial state to a final state, and the initial state, we assume it to be near false vacuum, and final state somewhere near or in the domain of attraction of the true vacuum. And that can be written as a path integral. Again, very generic statement that we introduce, we project the initial states on the eigenstates of field operators and final states also on eigenstates of field operators, and evolution between these eigenstates is described by a path integral with just this type of path integral over all configurations connecting these two. Okay, that's the basics. When we want decay probability, yeah, that's even more basic. We just square the amplitude. Okay, so square amplitude and sum over all possible final states which are in the domain of attraction of true vacuum. And then here we get actually, when we perform the summation, we get a kind of projector on true vacuum, yeah?
Sergey, are you gonna be more specific about what you mean by states near the true vacuum?
I tried not to, but perhaps we can discuss at the end. Yeah, you can ask me again at the end.
Okay, thank you.
since you've been stopped, and I don't know if this is the same question, but Are you really going to be working with field eigenstates, or do you have in mind that you'll be using some sort of a vacuum state for your initial and final states?
Initial and final are not field eigenstates. Yet at this point they are arbitrary eigenstates, and of course at the end they will be vacuum states that they want. I mean, at the next slide it will be vacuum states. Okay. So at this point there are some states. Well, can be vacuum state or coherent states around that vacuum, for example. So this projector, and then once I sum, I represent, so here every factor I represent as a path integral. So I get two paths, one, one like this, and another like that, actually. And this integration over intermediate states glues these two paths together. So now I can think that I'm just considering like the field defined on this roundabout path, yeah, that goes forward to the final time and backward. And here in this final time, I insert projector on the true vacuum, whatever it means. So I get this type of path integral where I integrate over all configurations on this path and two sets of initial states, yeah, because I consider square. Any questions?
And we're in Lorentzian signature or Euclidean signature?
In Lorentzian signature. Yeah, importantly, I'm always in Lorentzian signature, yeah. So you see time is real here. I can shift a bit. Yeah, what I can do, I can shift a bit these like the endpoints of the contour up and down in the complex plane. That's always possible. And that's actually what is done in informalism in field theory. Yeah, so we're just considering this type of contours with, yeah, actually, I will come back to that, the relation to in informalism. Okay, so far, so good. So this is an expression, yeah? But now you see, if I now just move this term around here, what I get inside is this object. Oops. Why it's so strange, okay. Is this object. So from the initial state, I get this type of projector, but this is nothing but the density matrix of this initial state, which was, for the moment it was pure, so it's a density matrix of a pure state. But now I know immediately how to generalize this reasoning for a mixed state. I just need to insert the density matrix of the state inside. And consider the same path integral. Yeah, so it's a path integral over all configurations on this contour and over initial and final conditions with the matrix elements of the density matrix. Of course, we want to do all the calculation in the semi-classical limit. So we take all the integrals here with the saddle point. So in particular, the integral over intermediate configurations, we take it with the saddle point and we get that we need to find a solution of field equations on this type of contour. So we know now where the bounds lives. The bounds lives on this type of contour in the complex plane. Boundary conditions, yeah, and the boundary conditions of that solutions are set by these matrix elements of the density matrix. Because when I perform integrals with these two initial states, over these two initial states, I will get actually boundary conditions on the solution. Okay, so we get the answer for the first question, and also we get the answer to the second question. Now we can stay outside black hole. Once we have the formalism for arbitrary mixed state, we don't need to go inside. We can stay outside. Yeah, outside the Hartle-Hawking and Unruh vacuum, they are just described by some density matrix. In Hartle-Hawking case, this is just thermal density matrix. And in Unruh vacuum, it's thermal for outgoing modes and vacuum for incoming modes. Yeah, and we can write down expressions for those matrices and perform the integrals, the integrals with these matrix elements. To make this story short, I'm omitting a lot of details, how these integrals are performed, what we are doing, but after all, this is just computing a bunch of Gaussian integrals. To make this story short, here are the boundary conditions that follow from this calculation. So we have, like my bound solution, so it lives on this contour, and in the past, yeah, in the far past, I assume that it linearizes. Or if you want, it's a requirement that it linearizes for all this formalism to be applicable, yeah, that I can talk about initial final states of the free field theory. So it linearizes, so it can be, so then it's decomposed into modes with some coefficients, C alpha and C alpha bar, Why there are two sets of modes? Because there are positive frequency modes and negative frequency modes. These C's are not complex conjugate to each other in general, because this solution need not be real at all, and actually it cannot be real. Yeah, one can show that it cannot be real. So it must be complex valued. But it's okay. We can have saddle points of an integral, of a real integral in a complex domain. So there are these modes here on the upper part of the contour. The same decomposition is performed on the lower part. And again, these coefficients are different from these ones. Why? Because the solution, again, must contain a cut here. Otherwise, we would get a trivial integral, a trivial path integral. So yeah, so there's a cut. Okay, the decompositions are different, but that's a single one analytic function in the complex plane. In the simplest case, okay, there are some variants of that. Well, and here are now the boundary conditions. So for empty vacuum, if we are just, if the vacuum doesn't have any excitations, nothing is thermal, then the boundary conditions are just that the negative frequency components, positive frequency components are absent. Oh, on the upper part of the contour, positive frequency components are absent. On the lower part, negative frequency components are absent. So basically these two terms go away.
Sorry, Sergey, when you say vacuum, do you mean Boulware vacuum or some other vacuum?
Yeah, for a black hole, that would be Boulware vacuum. But that same thing works for Minkowski vacuums. In fact, here I didn't specify what is precise geometry or what is precise set of modes. So for example, if I want tunneling from Minkowski vacuum, I would get this type of boundary conditions. In the context of black hole, this is Boulware vacuum, you're right.
Thanks.
And for thermal bath, it's more complicated. So thermal bath, it mixes boundary conditions on the upper and lower parts. In this way, saying that, the positive frequency component on the upper part must be proportional to the positive frequency component on the lower part with the coefficient, with the factor depending on the frequency of the mode and the temperature. It's kind of Boltzmann factor here appears. And a similar relation for the other set of coefficients. Now we also understand what we need to do for Unruh vacuum. Well, we can also derive it directly, but we understand what will be the case. So the case will be that in the Unruh state, we don't have like the modes that fall into black hole. They are in vacuum. They have zero occupation numbers. So for them, we will have these boundary conditions. For modes that go outside, outgoing modes, they are in thermal state. So for them, we'll get the second set of boundary conditions. Because you see the boundary conditions, they don't mix modes with different frequencies. That's property of thermal bath, in fact. That would not be true in general, for general density metrics. Yeah, but in thermal bath, everything is incoherent. Yeah, so there is no mixture. There is a twist to that. Which actually makes it closer related to the informalism. Because look at the path integral at the generating functional for time-ordered Green's functions in the informalism. That's given by this expression. And the integral actually runs along the same contour C. Yes, as I said, this is a standard contour that appears in the informalism in quantum field theory, non-equilibrium quantum field theory. And lo and behold, this is exactly the same integral that we had for the bounds, in particular the boundary conditions that we'll obtain when we perform the Gaussian integrals for the Green function. We'll get exactly the same boundary conditions that we obtained for the bounds. So we can reformulate the problem. Instead of saying that we are solving differential equation with certain boundary conditions, we can say that we will be solving integral equation where the kernel is taken to be a time-ordered Green's function along this contour. And that automatically will implement the right boundary conditions. So this integral equation principle contains all of the information. Yeah, so the kernel, as I said, is given by the Green's function, and the source is given by the derivative of the interaction potential. Yeah, so we remove the mass term from here, and here we have only interaction. Now, in principle, in general, I don't know if this equation is easier than the previous one, than the differential equation. And perhaps it's actually even more complicated, because the integral equations are usually worse than differential equations for, say, numerical implementations. But there are some, but there are cases where this equation can be easier to solve. That's when this source is well localized. So like interaction is non-trivial only at distances which are much smaller than 1/mass. So there are different scales in the problem. Yeah, so the core of the bound solution is small. In that case, the source can be replaced by a delta function. And we just get that outside the core, the bound solution is given by the Green's function itself. And actually, that would be the case that I like in the toy model that that I'm coming to.
Sergey, can I ask about that? I mean, the minimum size of the bubble is roughly 1/m. So how is it true that the interactions are spread in a spatial region that's smaller than that?
Well, bubble is 1/m, but this 1/m can be a solution of free equations. It can be just, you know, tail, you know, given by the free field equation. And the nonlinear interaction can happen in a smaller core. That will be an explicit example that I will be considering. And I think the same happens actually in the standard model. So I can explain why afterwards. But in the explicit model that I will be discussing, that must be clear. Okay, yeah, let you ask this question after if it doesn't become clear.
Thanks.
Okay, so at this point, summary. So what we need to do, we need to solve classical field equations on a contour like this in a complex time plane with the boundary condition on the mode decomposition in the asymptotics. Or alternatively, you can solve the integral equation. Then our suppression exponent will be essentially given by the imaginary part of the action of the bounds along this contour. So now this is a problem which is in principle solvable. We can put it on a computer, but it's really hard. It's really hard. So yeah, so if we just formulate it, you can say, okay, thank you. Now we can never do it. But there are cases when we can do it. Okay, first, these are cases that which are well known. Yeah, but just in this sense, it's just a formulation of what we already knew. For example, for vacuum bounds, like tunneling from Minkowski, we must reproduce the well-known result. So how my bounds, how is it related to the standard one, which lives in Euclidean? In fact, it turns out that it's related in a very simple way. So the standard bounds lives here in Euclidean time, and my bounds is just analytic continuation of this solution to the contour that I'm studying. And it is easy to see that indeed, you know, like when I continue Euclidean bounds to this type of contour, it satisfies Feynman boundary conditions, which are precisely my boundary conditions for the vacuum solution. And then also they say the action, which I will calculate along my contour, is just equal to the usual Euclidean action because I can deform one contour to the other, and the integrals at infinity do not contribute because the bounds vanishes fast enough. Same story for thermal transitions for periodic instanton. So periodic instanton again lives in Euclidean, but it turns out that if I take this periodic instanton, which everybody knows very well, and analytically continue it to the contour I'm discussing, it actually will satisfy my thermal boundary conditions. So there's a relation between positive and frequency modes. So again, actually my bounds is the same as well-known periodic instanton. And also the integral along my contour is actually equal to the integral of periodic instanton along one period. Why? Because I can deform this red contour into blue one, and the integrals over this horizontal part of this blue contour, they cancel each other because of periodicity. My periodic instanton is periodic. Yeah, that's how the name, as the name says. So this will cancel each other, and what will remain will be integral along just over one period. So perfect. Yeah, we recovered that. Yeah, and moreover, actually, there is some interesting detail here that in this way we can also describe phalerons. Yeah, so if I just live in Euclidean and crank up temperature, at some point periodic instantons do not exist anymore, and I get phalerons. And but the phaleron looks a bit weird because it's not clear how it actually interpolates between two vacuums. It's just constant, it doesn't depend on time, static solution. Nevertheless, we believe that it corresponds to jumps over the potential barrier. And yeah, this formalism actually allows to reinterpret these phaleron solutions as real tunneling, as the solution starting from the false vacuum and tunneling on top of this phaleron. Okay, I can say more about this at the end if there are questions.
Sergey, maybe I have another question before we leave the contours, if you'd like to. So, I mean, is it fair to say that your initial state and your final state contain so the initial state kind of contains this exponentially growing piece because you necessarily complexified in the time plane? Is that like the manifestation of the instability or?
Exponentially, yeah, I don't think it's exponentially growing.
Why you showed this initial solution, you know, one constant e to the I omega t, another constant e to the minus I omega t, but t is complex. It's got a small imaginary part, right?
Ah, for the periodic instanton. For the vacuum box.
For either case, right? I mean.
No, for vacuum, it doesn't contain any growing piece. That's precisely the Feynman conditions. So that my solution up here contains only decreasing piece.
Oh, okay.
That's why
so
I can analyze.
Oh, okay, thanks. Yeah, got it. I just forgot which coefficients were zero and which were, thanks. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, that's already said. So in general, it's a hard numerical problem and the Unruh vacuum seems to be general case. We didn't find any simplification of this problem in general for the Unruh. So we really need to stick to this contour and no useful Euclidean picture exists. But that's where we want to go to one plus one dimensions, and hope to get something good out of it. So yeah, let's consider a toy model in one plus one dimensions. Yeah, following the advice of Freeman Dyson. So that's our toy model. So we consider a metric of Dilaton black hole. Yeah, there are actually a lot of simplifications in two dimensions. So one simplification is that the metric is always conformally flat. Yeah, and I have just, so I have two coordinates, a spatial coordinates, time coordinate, and the metric is conformally flat, always. We consider an explicit form of this prefactor, not prefactor, but this metric coefficient omega, given for Dilaton black hole solution. Yeah, there are solution of Dilaton gravity. There is nothing special for us about Dilaton gravity in this context, just convenient. And this is a nice function which admits exact solution for the mode functions, which we actually also don't need at the end of the day. And these black holes, they correspond to temperature. Temperature is essentially given by lambda. Okay, there is some lambda over 2 pi factor. One difference between 4 dimensions and 2 dimensions that already appear here is that this lambda is a parameter of the theory. It doesn't depend on the mass. So the temperature in 2 dimensions doesn't depend on the mass of the black hole. It's just the parameter which we put in by hand, in the Lagrangian of Dilaton gravity. Again, for us, it doesn't seem to be important because we are considering tunneling in external metric. So yeah, that's just our metric. And for the dynamical field that we're considering, phi, the scalar field, we take inverted, we take mass term, okay, that's something which should be there, plus an inverted Liouville potential. If we look at the plot, I mean, how this potential looks like, it actually looks like this. First it just for actually large range of values of the field, it's just quadratic function. And then it quickly reaches the maximum and then quickly turns over. goes steeply down. Reminds us about standard model. In fact, yeah, if you think of it, so qualitatively it looks the same. Again, we didn't choose it for that reason, but seems we can be capturing something relevant. And furthermore, to make model even more analytically tractable, we assume this hierarchy between the parameters M and kappa, so the mass and the parameter and the Liouville potential. Actually, it's even exponential hierarchy. Yeah, so the logarithm of this ratio will treat we treat it as one, as much bigger than one. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, I think I have to go faster at this point. So, of course, the main nice feature of this model that if we forget about the mass term, we get just Liouville equation, and that is something solvable, exactly solvable. So, I mean, meaning that really solvable. So it admits a general solution. The general solution of this equation is parameterized by two arbitrary functions, f1, f2, depending on the light cone coordinates u and v. This term here, this product becomes much larger than one, we can neglect unity here, and the solution splits into a sum of functions depending on u and v, which is the same as solution of a massless free theory. So, So maybe that should answer the question about the structure of the solution. So there is nonlinear core, which will be given essentially by this parameter kappa. Yeah. So that's where the theory is really nonlinear. I mean, and that solution applies. But if we go outside that core, the field configuration becomes the same as in free theory, and is matched to the Green's function at short distances. So, and this says the solution has a small core, which is essentially nonlinear, and with the size much smaller than the mass, and a long tail with the size 1/m. Yeah, so in this sense, the size of the bubble is really 1/m, but essentially in this tail, the bubble is just solution of three massive equations. And moreover, this solution coincides with the Green function, the time ordered Green function. Because essentially at small distance, it also has the same form. It has the form of two functions depending only on u and v, because I mean, it also becomes a solution of massless equation at short distance. But there's a constant here. And that constant is actually important. And that depends on the mass. Yeah, but maybe before I go there, okay, so yeah, I mean, constant we'll discuss in a second. So before we go to the constant, what about these functions g1 and g2? We can calculate them. They are calculable, of course. This is just nothing but Green's function of the massive field in a non-trivial metric. And we find that this function g1 is the same for Hartle-Hodgkin and Unruh vacuum. Because it essentially corresponds to right moving modes, to outgoing modes, so it's the same. But the function g2 it is different, and for Hartle-Hodgkin modes, for the thermal modes, it has this form. For Unruh vacuum, when the modes are not excited, it has this form. Completely different. So here's some periodic function of v in complex plane. Here it's just linear function. And then what we can do, we can find these functions, we can adjust these functions f1 and f2 in the nonlinear solution precisely in the way to match these functions g1 and g2. So in other words, we see how the long distance asymptotics of the core match the short distance asymptotics of the Green's function. So then I already said that, yeah, there is this constant here. And that constant is actually important. It's crucial for completely fixing the solution and then for the value of the action. So if you want all the results or different like actions or different suppressions, they hinge on this constant. yeah, looks a bit technical, well, but that's how it is. Christina, do I have 5 more minutes?
Yeah, feel free to take the time you need.
Okay, great. Okay, so here are these commands on, there are some commands on this, on how this constant is calculated. So this constant, it's just nothing but expansion of the massive time-ordered Green's function. Okay, that's expanded in terms of eigenmodes, and eigenmodes live in a effective potential provided by the metric. And that's how the potential looks like in our case. And then, there are modes, there are outgoing modes that I plot in red. So they are outgoing, so they have only outgoing mode on the right, and they have both components on the left, yeah, because there are some there is some reflection from the potential. And there are also modes, there are infalling modes, green, which are left moving on the left and have two components on the right. So these green modes are in vacuum for the Unruh state, so basically not excited. And the thermal modes are thermally excited, both for the Hartle Hodgkin and for the Unruh. And moreover, there are also these excited modes that are actually localized around black hole, yeah? Because this effective mass is redshifted near the horizon, so it goes to zero, and we have modes with all frequencies down to zero. And these modes are excited as well, and they don't fly away, but they are there, they are around the black hole, and actually they have a long tail of order 1 over m outside black hole. And most of this constant, which is over important, as I said, all important for our calculation, it comes from the soft modes, which we, in two dimensions, we have a lot of them. Yeah, if my temperature is larger than the mass, I populate massively low frequency modes. So this value of the constant, they are different for different cases. So for Unruh, what is that? So that's, yeah. So for the Hartle-Hodgkin case, for the Hartle-Hodgkin vacuum, the value is this. If we are near the black hole, so if we are in that regime where we have contribution from localized modes, and it is given, it is twice smaller if we are far away when the localized modes do not contribute. For Unruh, near the horizon, we have this expression, and notice, yeah, it's still lambda over m, but notice that the coefficient is different. And far away, it is yet a fourth expression, yet with a different coefficient. But what is important, that actually does not die out, because these modes that are radiated, again, that's peculiarity of two dimensions, that they travel without losing in their amplitude. Yes, so basically this, they propagate and they continue contributing into thermal fluctuations far away from, well, they're not thermal in that case, but in the field fluctuations far away from the black hole. What is important to take home from this slide are that these constants are different, okay, whatever their precise values are. And here we have the results for the suppression. That's quite busy, but that's the last slide that I have.
Hey, Sergey, sorry to interrupt. Can you just remind me what lambda is? I'm sure you said it, I just missed it.
Yeah, lambda is a temperature, essentially.
Oh, thanks.
Up to a factor of 2 pi. So here is the dependence of the suppression on lambda, yeah, which is equal to temperature. Blue is the suppression for the Hartle-Hodgkin periodic instantons. Yeah, so just thermal transitions. So it we start from the suppression in flat space time at zero temperature. Yeah, which is given by this. Okay, has some value. Well, it's enhanced by this log. So then, yeah, it decreases down to about 1/2 of this suppression, of the flat empty space suppression. And then the regime of tunneling changes. So at smaller temperatures, we have periodic instantons. Here, we start getting jumps onto sphaleron. So then it just decreases as 1/lambda times the energy of the sphaleron. The sphaleron in the black hole background. So green, Green is the tunneling Hartle-Hawking, tunneling from Hartle-Hawking state, but far away from the black hole. So essentially without black hole. Yeah, if there were no black hole, just thermal bath, that would be the curve here. And it is similar just up to some rescalings. So it's the same as blue up to rescaling, you know, this point by a factor of two. And also correspondingly, the coefficient in this tail, you know, that describes the tail, the coefficient, you know, which we divide by lambda is also different by a factor of two. And that, if you want, is the effect of geometry. Yeah, so black hole, it not only hits the, it not only hits the universe, so the effect of heating is this green curve, but it also changes the geometry. And in fact, in two dimensions, it's very simple. So the sphaleron in the presence of black hole is just half of the sphaleron without black hole. Yeah, because black hole is a boundary of the space, if you want. So we can, like the sphaleron attached to black hole is just half of the full sphaleron, yeah?
And can you remind me what alpha is again, sorry?
What is what?
The alpha, the definition.
Alpha is the coupling constant. So alpha was, so alpha is a coupling constant, which was dimensionless coupling constant in front of the action. 1 over alpha is in front of the action. So it's always there to control a semi-classical expansion. But in our case, we have additional enhancement by this large log. But this one is kind of inside, that one appears inside the already semi-classical limit. But to take the semi-classical limit, we always assume this. Does it answer your question?
I'm not completely sure in the sense that, so the can you show me the action again? I'm losing track of the.
Here.
Yeah, there you, right.
Yeah.
Got it.
So I have one question. So for example, in the original work in by Roos et al., the B0 is completely determined by the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole, especially in the case where the black hole disappears after the phase transition. In your setup, how does the entropy of a black hole affect the decay rate?
Yeah, very good question. I think I don't know. I don't see any immediate relation to the entropy because it's just like tunneling in external geometry. Yeah. So if I were considering tunneling, you know, without black hole, just you know, with some other external geometry, I also would apply the same logic and I would get some answer, which may be different from flat space time. Does not seem to have any relation to the entropy.
I'm interested in this point because, I think the Euclidean technique is a nice way to obtain the entropy of the black hole. And, and to be honest, I don't know how we can get the entropy of black hole from the Lorentzian passing integral that you are working on. I'm very interested in this.
Yeah, that will be interesting to study. Perhaps one has to include back reaction on the geometry to see what happens with the black hole, because in our limit, entropy is infinite. Yeah, black hole is infinitely massive. We don't take into account back reaction. So hard to say what happens with that.
Another question. So it is related to Naito's question, but as far as I understand, the claim that the catalysis black hole enhances the decay rate owing to the fact that people take into account the back reaction, or they also solve the balance equation for the metric. And in this, in your case, does it take into account that, or the metric is taken just as background?
Metric is background.
I see. Then, so Papa, it is something you mentioned, but how to take into account the back reaction in this?
That will be one of the open questions at the end. So far there is no back reaction. So, and we see that there is enhancement, there is catalysis. In Hartle-Hawking, it's really a thermal. Yeah, so as I, thermal plus geometry. Two effects, in fact, yeah? because purely thermal is green, plus geometry is blue. So now for UNRWA, most interesting. So for UNRWA, we get the following. So we get the red curve for tunneling near black hole. And actually, that's the most interesting regime where the bubble is formed around black hole. And we can find it, well, actually up to this point. So that red curve, the solid curve is what we can really compute and are confident. So what we see that it's different from blue. Perhaps not dramatically different, but it's different. Yeah, and the suppression is bigger. The rest of this curve, which I draw here with dashed line, we cannot find semi-classical solution with our method. It looks like even in this simplified model, we need some numerical investigation. But I think in this model, the suppression will still go to zero as 1/λ. Why? We can understand that if we actually consider the orange curve. The orange curve is tunneling in UNRWA state far away from the black hole, where geometry is not relevant at all, and I just have a flux of particles coming from the black hole, from one direction, because it's UNRWA. So here we also have solution which we are confident is we are confident in, and then they stop. We cannot obtain them with our method anymore, but we see what happens with them when we approach this point. They become elongated, in time, if you want. They become elongated, and that's also how the periodic instantons in real time behave when we approach the Sphaleron transition limit. So our guess is that above these energies, we are tunneling on top of a Sphaleron, which we cannot find. Why? Because that existence of the Sphaleron essentially requires, depends on the mass term itself. Yeah, if I had a flux of massless particles, they could not collide with each other and produce any Sphaleron or any thermal transition. When I have particles with the mass in this flux, I have a lot of particles with momenta of order mass. Momentum of one particle are smaller, or the other ones are bigger, and they can catch up each other and collide. And that's how they produce the Sphaleron in this case, we think. And then we can estimate the suppression in this regime just by very simple stochastic argument, which we checked works for Hartle-Hawking vacuum, where we know solutions exactly. So the stochastic argument is just the question, what's the probability for the field to develop such a large fluctuation that it goes over potential barrier? And because the fluctuations are dominated by soft modes, this fluctuation will happen in the region of order 1/m. And then, if I have such a region which goes over the barrier, then it will evolve into the true vacuum, actually run away in my case. And these fluctuations, this characteristic size of fluctuations, thermal fluctuations, quantum fluctuations, there is no distinction between them. This formalism is easily calculated again from the Green's function, and it always behaves as λ/m times alpha squared times some number, which is different for different vacuum. But if I take this number, substitute into this formula, I have a nice match to what I found at smaller temperatures. So, so what did we reach? What did we attain? We attained that the toy model, we have now a toy model, we studied a toy model, which allowed us to explicitly see the difference between different quantum states, and kind of test the general formalism, which without application could be just some empty, empty thing. And we see that, these suppressions are really different for different states and kind of follow the intuitive pattern. So suppression, so tunneling from UNRWA vacuum is less probable than from Hartle-Hawking vacuum, but more probable than in flat space, than in empty space. That's basically the second point. Still, in this particular model, in this particular setup, the suppression goes to zero at high temperature. The suppression, for the UNRWA case. then you can ask, is it the general feature which you also to be to expect to be transferable to the four dimensions or not? Perhaps not. And perhaps there are some key points that this simplified, oversimplified model does not capture. And one of them is the gray body factors. So recall my potential was just monotonic like this. So I didn't have any gray body factors. In Schwarzschild geometry, the effective potential for the modes actually goes up and it grows as the temperature of the black hole increases. So this actually, this potential is of order lambda itself would be. Meaning that there are no soft modes actually radiated away by the black hole. They, if any, they stay inside or close to the black hole. And that may change the probability of tunneling quite significantly because we see that, basically conclusion from this study is that gray body seem to be important. Gray body factors seem to be important. And second is that there is no dispersion in two dimensions. Yes, so in higher dimensions, I have black hole, so it radiates. And you know, like I have 1/r² suppression of the energy density, which is not there in two dimensions. In two dimensions, I just have constant flux. And again, that can be a factor which I decrease dramatically the number of particles far away from black hole, and that may suppress tunneling further. So basically, these are two features that must be taken into account at the next step. Thank you.
Thanks, Sergei. Are there any more questions?
Excuse me. Can you make it clear that the separation go to zero means the separation for the exponentiate in the probability or separation for the probability itself, which is
in the rate. So I have like the rate of the probability of tunneling per unit time. Yeah. So that's mm-hmm. the rate. So suppression in the rate goes to zero.
Then the exponentiate is the same order. So so the bounce, the value of the bounce is same order, right?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
The probability is expressed as the exponential minus some positive constant, and mm-hmm. and the constant is not so different for the Hartle-Hawking vacuum and Arnold vacuum. Is it right? Or the order is well suppressed?
No, are you talking on the regime where the exponential suppression disappears completely?
Mm-hmm.
No, in that regime, I cannot calculate. I can calculate only as long as exponential suppression is bigger than unity. Yes, so that's semi-classical approximation. And as long as I'm in the semi-classical approximation, the rate is given. Let me see if I can. Okay, let me write it here. So the rate is given mm-hmm. by e to the power minus b. And yes. This b is different still, for different vacuum. But yeah, it mm-hmm. becomes. One and essentially and eventually zero for very high temperatures. Of course, what remains in that case is the prefactor here. Mm-hmm. This prefactor I don't calculate at this point. In principle, it can be done by considering one loop corrections on top of this bound solution.
Hmm. So
I don't know if I answered your question.
Okay, then. So then the I suppose if I remember correctly, the point of the Gregory's paper is that B is near order one at the Planck scale black hole.
Yeah, for black holes heavier than Planck scale.
Yes. Then mm-hmm. If the order of the B is not so changed, then the problem of Higgs vacuum instability or something is still remain?
Well, if B goes to zero or to one, for any black hole, you know, like, for any black hole where we can trust the calculation, then the fate of vacuum instability does not change. Yeah. But that's the main question. Does it go to order one number or it remains bigger than the one always? In the toy model that we studied, it goes to one, yeah, at some somewhat higher temperature than for Hartle-Fockner calculation, but still.
But maybe it's due to the two-dimensional feature.
Exactly. That's the point. So this, we not ready. Well, I'm not claiming that I want to extend this conclusion to higher dimensional black holes. And actually, I rather suspect that it does not extend to higher dimensional black holes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So related to that point, Sergey, I sent you an email where when I was a grad student, we did some dimensional analysis about the second point you make here, and it doesn't work. You never get enough energy in the right region of space to make it happen. I'm curious to hear your thought about that.
Right. I agree with you. Yes. Indeed, one can do these estimates. Yes. Or the effect of gray body factors. I mean, how they will. I think what you are talking. Yeah, there are these two effects. I think you are talking about this one. There is spread of energy. Yeah, and you never get large enough region, which would be hot enough to make the transitions. And another, which seems to be also important at this point, actually, I mean, from the study, are these gray body factors that you don't radiate even. I mean, you don't even radiate soft modes outside. Yeah.
So I had a question though as well. So. I want to try and understand the family of solutions. So how do you know that these solutions you found for the, you know, in this particular example, for this potential in this one-dimensional problem, how do we know that these are the relevant saddle points? Like you just found these solutions that you could match your in-state to your out-state, but could there be other solutions that are more relevant, or what do you comment on that?
That's a very good point always in this semi-classical approach, because if you find something, you don't. So I think what I can, what we can say that, that these solutions, we made sure that they satisfy proper boundary conditions. Yeah. Also, they kind of look like correct in the inner structure, so they do go somewhere, you know, towards the true vacuum. Yeah. Actually, analytically continued, you know, along the real time axis, they develop singularities. Actually, in this case, it's very simple to see that you go to true vacuum, that the field must become singular. If there are any other solutions, they should satisfy the same boundary conditions. That kind of boundary conditions are derived for the saddle point. Well, of course, also there are some. Yeah, there are more complicated cases when the integral is saturated on the boundary, and then you should consider something like constraint instantons. Yeah, there are actually all possible kinds of complications. But to zeroth order, any relevant solution must satisfy the boundary conditions I derived. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the question whether there are other solutions that we, because at some point we started doing cutting and matching, you know, the simplification just to find it analytically. So.
But I guess the hope
is some solutions which are extended, for example. Yeah.
But the hope is that your choice of boundary conditions uniquely, hopefully, specifies this solution that's relevant to the problem.
Yes. Yeah. That's kind of assumption which you even we didn't really use it, but we're assuming that there is a single solution. Yeah. That's kind of right this way, which is which need not be true. In fact, in quantum mechanics, that's definitely not true in many quantum mechanical models. There are chaotic models where there are many solutions which all contribute comparably. So in this sense, I think there is here this probably naive hope that quantum field theory is better. I think it has been, this naive hope has been kind of verified, well, not really verified, but I would say supported by studies in other questions, like, for example, tunneling induced by particle transitions. And there also similar type of boundary value problem appears and was numerically solved. And there are various arguments that the solution is unique. And basically, well, at least this is a unique solution connecting to vacuum bounds. Yeah, if we start from vacuum bounds, then we uniquely get a family of solutions, and there is nothing else. There is no bifurcation, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, even that is not true. There is a bifurcation, but there is a way prescription to go through this bifurcation in a well-defined way.
Okay, we're running over time, so I save my other questions for now.
Yeah,
time.
We should discuss it more. Yeah.
Okay, maybe we can thank Sergey again, and we can stop there. Thank you.